Good evening, everyone. This is Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, and it's time for The Invocation of Presence by E.J. Gold. We've been working our way through it. I think we're on the 14th week, and we're on Chapter 4. Last week, we spent some time on the first part of Chapter 4. Chapter 4 is entitled The Second Wind Phenomena. And it's curious because in the first half of it, EJ's talking about a sustained effort. And of course, in all the literature that you find, in all everything you find about mastering anything, it's this idea of continual effort. And there's a lot of theories out there. There's one theory is it's like 10,000 hours of practice.
Wow.
You know, and that's what gets you into mastery, and it's the same. And you know I was just reading a text about the Tibetan Book of the Dead a couple of nights ago, and he says, and this particular thing you just repeat 100,000 times.
Oh yeah, there you go.
And in the way of when the pilgrim is trying to find out in heart, he's to say it 100 times, and it'll move or automatically. But think about that. You put it.
David, you're breaking up on the phone.
Nature to the work that we're doing. And then also last week, Ivan, we were looking at a phrase where EJ says that you feel, if you notice that you are literally walking around in sleep, you'll be terrified, and you'll be incentivized at that point to start to work towards invocation and the steady effort of presence. And then we talked about the idea that can you observe your machine and its blockages to such an event just objectively without judging it, mm-hmm. and just noting that's how that machine works. Happens to be the one that you're incorporated in, but it's just an objective fact. and then you go on from there. So what I'd like to do, though, is I'd like to go ahead and start to jump into the second half of the chapter, and I'd like to start on page 15. And on the right-hand side of the 15, there's this big notice there plugged in. And on that page 15, it says, why don't you read that for us, Ivan? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Awakening is not the end of work on self. It is the very beginning of work on self.
So I thought about that, and it's pretty clear to me that that's the truth of anything. I mean, anything that requires any skill set, you have to get to a minimal level, right? You know, like Sean's a guitar player. Like, just somebody walking in and it's like their first few weeks on the guitar, that's going to be really hard to work with them, right?
Yes.
It's hard because they haven't gotten to what's called the minimal level. Mm-hmm. It's the minimal level. And only when this becomes second nature to us, which is hard. It takes a lot of time. Then when it becomes second nature, then we're able to hang out in the space called the work chamber. Prior to that, it's too hard to hang out there, both for the participant and for those in the work chamber. And we've had that experience over the years. So that's the beginning of it. Okay. And then jumping down a couple of paragraphs, EJ continues, this process of voluntary self-annihilation is known as the 10,000 deaths. Because each time personal annihilation is almost near, we draw back, and the veil invariably falls, except for the last time, and we must begin again. So, and then he goes on, there's no objective barrier exists to prevent success.
That's actually a very profound statement.
Right? No objective barrier, only a subjective barrier to the second wind of personal annihilation, about which we will talk sometime. What do you think about that? I mean, do you believe, and I say this to everybody online, and I don't know who's on the chat right now, Dan, but do you believe that's something that you can achieve, can you believe that you can become awakened?
Is that a rhetorical question?
It's not a rhetorical question. I actually am asking it. There's a reason to ask it and to answer it, by the way. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, Panjo says, it means it is all up to us.
It is all up to us. I definitely believe I can become awakened and more awakened.
Mm-hmm.
I know that through my efforts along these lines of work, that more essential self will be allowed to come out.
I certainly believe that. I believe that I have had minimal experiences of the waking state that E.J. writes about, and that it's possible to home in on it, you know, to cultivate it. I find that the biggest difficulty in practice is this the need for constant repetition, the need for motivation to remember to do the exercise, to remember to do the invocation of presence, to remember to, you know, to get some kind of a reminder, not just to be in sleep all the time.
There's also a hidden barrier related to self-worth.
I'm not related to self-worth? Hmm.
Grocki says, I've never even been totally clear what being awakened means. And then he says he has to go, so he'll check the archives later.
Good.
Okay.
I understand that. Yeah, Judy.
Do you want to finish what you're saying first?
Well, I just wanted to say that there's a very deep subconscious sense that somehow others can become awakened. I've read about it. I can see in the books and the literature that others can do that. I really think that's wonderful. But when you start to consider, what about you? A different story. Go ahead, Judy.
Yeah, I think if we look at the term, can you hear me?
Yes.
Very nicely, yeah.
Okay, the term personal annihilation. And then if we look at 10,000 deaths, and then if we look at subjective barrier, the subjective barrier is the other side of the stick of the 10,000 deaths. It's the 10,000 subjective barriers or buffers of the ego, okay? And then along that entire spectrum of those 10,000 barriers of the ego, we move through our personal annihilation to the other side of the stick. That's the way I see it, is that there's a balance. There's a balance.
Absolutely.
There's we have to pay. We have to pay. And what
That's
we
correct.
Pay with is everything that is in the way, which is a lot.
Which is a lot. But we have to pay. And confidence arises from competency. Say that again. Your confidence of being able to invoke or to hang out in the invoked space comes from competency. How do you acquire competency? Sean?
Practice.
It's like too simple for the human mind. So if you work on this over and over and over again, the subtleties of doing it come up. And then more importantly, what comes up is what Judy is implying, is that your own set of barriers starts to come up. And self-reflection on that level begins anew. And it's a spiral. You increase your ability and you go up, only to find more subtle barriers, and then you get better at it, and then you find more subtle barriers, which are important and difficult, and sometimes, Judy, very even more difficult than, let's say, gross behavior, but they're all hard, okay?
Yeah, you know, the thing is, like, if you look at the term awakening, okay, and then you observe something. Let's just take one thing, a very important thing, keeping one's word, doing what one says one is going to do. So when something comes up and you said, I'm going to do this, and what all the resistance comes up, by doing it, that is where you are the witness to your own competency.
Yes.
Okay. The confidence doesn't arrive from the competency, okay, particularly as I see it. We have the competency, and utilizing our competency gives us more confidence as the tasks get larger.
That's right.
I see it as the opposite. That the I guess I agree with you. I just see it, you know, in a little different way. But it's these small things. You know, Gurdjieff said, do small things well, and that will lead to the next larger thing. So whether it's keeping one's word or being meticulous and detail-oriented and attention-focused when one does a task, it doesn't matter. You know, you have to start somewhere.
And where we find a lot of these issues that come up in us is interacting with our fellow workers. And we want to be dismissive if it's hard, rather than listening to them, rather than judging them out of the gate. To sit with them and listen is, particularly if they shake us up a little bit. You want to grab that quote from that is on that desk there. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Well, David, I'd just like to comment that, well, I'm not sure if this is the direction you're going in, but this statement that no objective barrier exists to prevent success, only a subjective barrier. You know, but this suggests to me that, you know, why EJ has tagged this process as voluntary evolution, you know, it's having to do with the will and having to do, and we have a bunch of our books, it's intentional, we tag our books transformational psychology, you know, and it's like, what I get out of this statement here is that, you know, it's not, it's like the whole exercise, the whole work of awakening the machine, this invocation of presence, it doesn't have to do with the, like, the physical evolution, like the fact that we're in a body, or that we're this human species, or that we're alive at a certain historical period, or that there's, that we are, you know, living at a certain level of affluence or comfort or poverty or discomfort, or any, in other words, none of these objective things are what is relevant to this practice. It's all, what's relevant is the voluntary aspect of the evolution and what I am going to do according by my own decision, by my own choice, in my own universe, let's say.
But if you begin to get into this area where your interest in evolution increases, you want to find ways and means of overcoming the natural barriers that are your subjective barriers.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying that this statement of EJ's reminds me that, you know, that what I have to actually, what I'm going up against in this practice is not like my eating habits, let's say, or what, you know,
correct,
what my, you know, how tall or short I am, or whether I'm an athlete or not, you know, whether I have, you know, stamina to run a couple of miles a day or all those kinds of things. Those strike me as more objective. I'm just saying, as in regard to, you know, what I'm dealing with is, can I remember to invoke presence, or, you know, or can I overcome the whatever negative impression I have of my own ability to invoke presence, let's say.
You know,
when you have a decent sensing of yourself as in the process of invocation, and we're going to look at some of those elements in a few minutes, when you have a decent sense of that, you'll know when you're off track. You'll sense when you are off track. And when you're off track, occasionally that will become a trigger mechanism for you to invoke your presence.
Yeah, that sounds a little like the chronic, like the using the chronic defense mechanism.
It's all part of it. You
yeah.
bet, Ivan. You bet.
Kianjo asks, what do we have to pay when we experience anger, a pernicious negative emotion? Anger can awaken us, but then efforts to invoke presence produce a strange state. What say you?
If you're actually honest about your anger in a case like that, Kianjo, there was a trigger, not in the other person, but in you, upon which the anger sourced. The anger came about. Now, don't get me wrong, there's sometimes when you objectively have to defend yourself. That's a different thing, right?
Okay. You mean on the street or something
yeah.
like that? Yeah. Okay.
You're being attacked or, you know, or abused or something. You have to stand up for yourself.
Okay.
And that those are appropriate moments for anger. But if it's a reactive anger, which is what I was getting to, is that if there's a sense of self maybe after it, maybe that strange feeling that follows is a sense of humility. Was the object of your anger so important that you were willing to express that negative emotion? That's expensive for you to do.
Yeah, that's the part of it that I would have just said, is that, you know, I noticed that when, if I get angry in the sense of out of control, you know, I get body temperature goes up and I turn different colors and get really angry about something. It's expensive. That's exactly the word I would use.
Mm-hmm.
Fine, because it's like it's a whole energy drain. It's like there's a real cost to that experience, to what I go through. And then, you know, I feel like I have to start all over at some lower point, you know, that I've drained myself, that I've given
yeah.
up, and also that I've been over-identified. I mean, there's like this damage
yeah.
that comes because something I was so identified as to get that angry about it.
We talked the last time about confession. And when you're angry in that way, it's like you're saying with all your energy at that time, I believe in this phenomenal world, in the external world. I believe in it so much so that all of my energy is going to go to it. I'm going to defend it. And it's like you put your flag down in the wrong territory, you know? And then when you start to feel the sense of self-reflection and you're able to invoke your presence in that mode, first of all, bravo, I say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to point something out about this thing about anger.
Sure.
I think what's critical here is being in touch with the fact that when anger arises, and I'm not talking about, you know, saving one's life, you know, there's a bear, you know, there's a guy bigger than a bear coming with you and a knife on the street. We're not talking about that. Let's talk about emotional anger, the thing that's righteousness, or someone says something you don't like, or calls you a name, or doesn't lies to you, or any of that. The first thing is to know it is the machine operating. And when the machine operates in the realm of anger, it takes on a particular type of breathing. So the machine has a breathing pattern for anger. So when, if you have that moment of recognition, this is not real, because it isn't. It's an automatic habitual reaction that you're going to have whatever you're angry about. All you have to do is breathe, and you can't change the breathing pattern and be angry at the same time, because anger is always accompanied by that breathing pattern. So it's really the recognition that the machine is having a good time. You know, it's doing its thing, you know, and what this is
doing
the only
its thing,
it can
baby.
Do. It's the only thing it can do, and will continue to do until you just say no, and breathe.
But what about this, D'Angelo is saying, that when he invokes his presence in that, is that right, Dan? That he invokes his presence, then there's a strange sensation, or?
Strange state.
This isn't about invoking presence, though. You know, I think we have to be careful about how we use this language, so we don't think we're actually doing something that we're not doing.
Amen. David, can you hear me? Am I connected?
Yeah, now I can.
My question had to do primarily, and your answer was very helpful, and Judy's was extremely useful as well. But when you find yourself angry, this happens to me, it happens to people with whom I work, what do you do when you kind of wake up to the fact that you're now in a negative state and going nowhere fast? What do you do then? Is there a certain insight into the effort you make at that point that you might have overlooked before? That's my question.
Wow. I think sometimes it takes a while to recognize patterns of behavior, and we can only do that through observation. I'll give you a personal example. I had a pattern of behavior for many years when I lost a big deal because somebody really made a mistake and didn't cover things in a way that would have led to success. I would go into blame, and I would point it out to them. This happened recently, and it was a tremendous loss financially, like $22,000. And basically when it happened, and I asked the question, did you do this, and the person hadn't done this, whatever, at that moment I knew, I saw it kicking in like I was going to tell her what she did wrong, because she did, and it made it a huge deal, but I didn't. I didn't do it. That was really difficult not to do it. So you have to recognize the pattern. Once you recognize the pattern, it actually becomes, it was still hard to pull back, but it becomes possible to pull back.
Possible.
It becomes possible, and then you have two roads in front of you. If you don't know the pattern, you don't have any choice. You're operating according to the law of accident rather than the law of fate.
I have a tendency towards anger Harry. And years ago, one of the methods that we had, we'd have community meetings on things, okay? And if somebody had an event or something, it'd be a big community meeting. And there was a community meeting surrounding one of my former wives, okay? And I remember walking into the room, and I could see the anger arising. It was like a little sprout coming up in my consciousness. And I remember deciding to take it, quote unquote, deciding. And I went for the anger.
Feels good sometimes, huh?
It was a disaster. Well, it felt good, but my God, was it ridiculous. And then, of course, the entire group helped me reflect on it. So
you can also be an actor. You know, you can consciously act it out.
That's different.
If the person really deserves to get it, but you can actually consciously act it out and be standing, you're ahead of it. And be ahead of it at the same time. That's a real art.
Well, that was different. That is an art. But that takes great observation skills. Go ahead.
Judy mentioned the two laws. I wanted to hear it again because I didn't the last sentence when she talked about the two laws. Following, one is one, and one is the other one. The faith. She mentioned faith, and then the other one, I didn't hear it. Do you remember,
if you
Judy?
Recognize the pattern, you're operating under the law of accident and the law of something else.
Got it, accident, and the other one was faith.
The law of
faith.
In other words, your
faith.
True destiny as a human being.
When you're, she's on the phone, we can't hear.
Loud enough.
No. You have to turn your phone off.
Got it.
Go ahead. So say it again.
When you are able to observe it.
Can't hear you.
You can't hear me?
Go ahead.
Okay, when you can observe it, one road will put you under the law of accident. In other words, it's the dark road. The other one, if you're able to pull back on the behavior, will put you on the road of the law of fate. That is your true destiny as a human being.
Fate.
Will you spell the word?
I mean, that's just the way I see it. Is that you're
spell the word.
Law of accident.
Judy.
Yeah.
Judy, spell the word that you're saying.
Law of fate, F-A-T-E.
Fate. She's saying fate.
Oh, okay.
Okay. We couldn't distinguish between fate and faith.
There's kind of a relationship here.
Yeah.
I mean, we would not be doing this work if we did not have faith that we had a higher purpose.
Very nice.
Okay.
David,
Harry,
she just observed here on the blog, if I may interject this. If you can observe without labeling, it is just energy moving through the body mind.
Who said that?
That was antimatter.
Oh, okay, good. Thanks.
That's a useful statement.
Very, very useful statement, because all of these thoughts are just vibrations moving through. Vibrations are just thoughts moving through the mind. Labeling actually puts them into the body. It actually moves them into the body when we label them.
The second wind of presence is called the non-phenomenal vision, and this vision indicates that the invocation of presence has been attained at least momentarily. We must be able to easily recognize this state. If we are to know whether our efforts at self-invocation and its accompanying sensation of emotional cleansing as our presence washes over the phenomenal self are effective. How do you like that?
Wow.
Emotional. If you are in that, you're starting to kind of get closer to some of the things in the ABD where he talks about the cleansing radiations of the higher. And when we allow ourselves to be subjected to that, what we were saying earlier, Judy, about the death of the personal ego, it's very difficult. That's all it is. It's a cleansing of it. The attachments we have are to this phenomenal world and our character and how the character works. I'm enormously attached to my character. I mean, it's remarkable. I want the world to conform to my character. It doesn't seem to do it all the time, though, unfortunately.
And make you happy, of course.
Well.
Isn't that what the world's for?
To make me happy.
Yeah, to make David happy.
There you go. Now we're getting somewhere. Okay, so.
Well, you know, I don't know if any of you know who Simone Weil is, but she was kind of a mystic.
Yeah.
And she said that unhappiness is the essential road to God and the supreme evidence of God's love.
So
interesting.
When you're working with the invocation and you feel that stretch that Judy's implying, that's the stretch of an emotional cleansing. You're slightly less attached to the phenomenal mechanisms of the machine, just slightly. There's a pain in that, and that's the payment, time and time again, the 10,000 deaths. Says, how can we expect to succeed in our work within the circle of invocation in which we invoke the really large presences?
David, talking about the payment and anger, what we're giving up, the payment, is we're giving up our right to be right.
That's right. So, that's right. You're right about that being right, you know?
You're right.
I love being right.
You're right.
And that, you know, right? We love being right. Hold back the anger or not explain to somebody what they did that was wrong or blah, 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 is giving up the right to being right. And I know that for me, you know, that has been a real challenge.
Well, now, upon reflection, I'm not so sure if you were right there, Judy.
Okay.
People here are voting, and it's not turning out good for you.
Okay, I can deal with that.
Good.
I'm at the point where I care a lot more what I think of myself than what other people think of me, because I'm pretty hard on myself.
We'll skip over the thing that says really large presences and move on.
Okay.
That's a different, whole other ballgame. Whole other ballgame.
I had something to read. Oh, there it is. Piangel says, the right ventral lateral neocortex is the part of the brain involved in two interesting functions, naming emotions, for example, I am angry, and mindfulness practice in Buddhist monks.
Okay, thank you. So,
are you on the top of 16?
Yeah. I'm looking for something. on the right-hand column on 16, in the Eastern tradition of this continuous state of presence and its corresponding non-phenomenal vision were called samadhi, meaning the undifferentiated, unveiled vision of the world. This unveiled vision, in which everything blends into a flat patchwork quilt of light and dark, color and form, without individual significance, and particularly without the dimension of depth, separation of forms and objects and the illusion of perspective, is usually misunderstood as an out-of-body experience, but is really just the unveiled vision of creation.
Yeah, try to drive a car.
When you start to uncouple yourself from the machine in its profound, you know, identification, you wind up in these places that you're able to see for a moment directly into creation. You can see the vibrancy of the moments of creation just bubbling forth. It's not easy, you're right, Judy, it's not easy to stand and operate in the phenomenal world during those times. Eventually, although it may take a very long time before one attains a permanent presence and the corresponding unveiled vision, one is able to adjust this vision while still performing activities in the machine. We have to become competent. We are in this world. We need to be able to move in and out of it in the appropriate manner. And then moving on to 17, even though individuals within the phenomenal vision are simply shadows passing over the face, they represent the presence and the present mood of our endless Creator. When one is awake, one can respond to this, knowing exactly how this vision represents the mood of the moment. It's like the hand of the Creator is reaching down all the time, seeking a way in. And are we able to say, yes, I'll accept it? And this is what I meant about the self-worth comment. You know, part of the thing that's blocking us is that I am not worthy. There's another element to that, that you're never worthy, but because of your existence. But it's sometimes you have to allow the grace that is attempting to come in. It wants to find ways and means to manifest on this plane, but it can only do it through appropriate hosts. It can't do it just through anybody. Sometimes that happens, but so that's part of our work. It's like we're working to annihilate ourselves, in a sense, to become the host of something. And then we're a different thing. Then we're a different thing. In the unveiled vision, colors become brighter, and all color vanishes. And objects may seem to have their own internal luminescence. And this will remind us of the literature of Castaneda when he's talking about Carlitos in his quests, you know, that you see things become so different. They are different. And when you're in this state of invoked presence, and you're not allowing yourself to be totally bombarded by the external world, it starts to look different. There's a different shimmer about it. And you'll notice that your attention picks stuff up in a different manner. It's not a reactive manner. It's an inclusive manner. And you start to see the connectivity that we all are in. Doesn't mean you have to go to work in the morning still, but it's possible to allow that to become, the vision becomes sharper. Individual objects are more distinct and indistinct. A larger part of the living whole than the isolated solid object. Sensations will intensify. Everything will seem clearly connected to everything else and to oneself. Sense that every once in a while. Allow yourself to sense that you are just a moment of creation. You're a drop of the divine. It is in there. It is manifesting throughout us. And in a sense, the Godhead calls us forth wanting to say, is this my home? And we seek and we reach forward and we say, that's my home. And we meet. We meet in the heart of the labyrinth. None of these events, of these effects, will seem at the time contradictory, although later they may not make rational sense. A faint sound of choral music or high-pitched buzzing may occur, alternating with periods of muffled, deadened silence. There's something that some people have reported, which I've heard it called angel talk. You'll hear voices, but suddenly your mentation is in a totally different way, and you hear slightly different words or different meanings. It's just different. And it's because you're standing in a fundamentally different place, and there's a different, you're seeing the world in different, and the sounds are different, the words and the meanings. And partly when sometimes you actually hear the heart of the person coming through, you can hear what they're actually trying to say. And you can have compassion, and hopefully sometimes from time to time, they can hear. They know they've been heard. Maybe that's all that's possible at that moment, is to allow them to interact with the emanation that's coming from you at those times. Everything seems delicate and exquisite. Feeling of warmth, friendliness seem to emanate from all objects, which suddenly seem alive, possessing their own definite consciousness. The attention of the surroundings upon you become very obvious. There may be an occasional urge to giggle or laugh aloud at the irony of it all, at the same time a feeling that the stillness and hushed atmosphere ought to be maintained as in a church, because you are in a church. That is what creates the church. That's the paint upon which a church is revitalized, is the paint, the emanation of the supplicants in true prayer. True prayer is a very difficult thing to achieve. It's not for me. It's literally the glorification of the divine. And that's just the job you do. So you seek that space, and that space is called the holy altar upon which we can interact. So every once in a while we can get in that. And it's important to allow yourself to acknowledge those spaces and to open your eyes a little bit more, because you're a carrier. You're a carrier of the divine. I don't know why we're given that or why we're opening, but we are. We are. You know, we go forth and we're carrying a little backpack, okay? I love the tarot card with the fool.
Mm-hmm.
Too bad Carlos or Bruto isn't on, who's the tarot reader. But that's just a lovely card where the voyager is sitting there with his little, and he has his bindle
stick in the bag,
his little bindle pack, and it's just, and he's just going along with a little dog, you know, and it's really the craggy mountains. But he's in like a blissful mode, of moving through the world, unattached. There's no attachment. He's cycling through his being, and his being is, it's sufficient unto itself. So, I don't know why I got stuck on that stuff. Here's something that I underlined. There's a profound feeling that you know something very great but inexpressible, and at the same time an exalted indifference to it all. I think I've had that since I've been a kid.
Yeah, I think that's a recognizable state. It's funny, the thought that I just had about it is that there's a zone before that to where, to me, there's art, you know, where I feel like I have insights and energy. And so I get inspired to write a poem, or I might be painting or doing something artistic. But this one, then you go, actually, this one here is where you actually no longer have the motivation. You know, you no longer are wanting to artifact something or record it or express it or interact or do anything, because it's just this indifference. It's just a state of presence.
Well, it's not of the world. It's not of the phenomenal world.
Well, it's actually, I'm trying to think of what is the relationship with it. You know, whatever the drive is or the need, where there may still be the machine involved, you know, to do something or accomplish something or make something or capture something, or, you know, all of those things are sort of, even though it might be artistic, I think it's part of grasping on to straws.
You mean the artistic expression is grasping on to straws?
It's like, it's still the gateway. It still has to do with signs and significations and, you know, traveling towards something, you know, being separate from something and then trying to get towards it or achieve it or capture it and so on. Where this state that he's describing here is it's like a stasis. I mean, you're there. You've arrived at something.
I think in many ways this phrase is like a kind of a label of my life. I mean, I remember when I was a very young child starting to feel this feeling. I had no words for it. I don't know that I have words for it now, other than I know I'm headed in the right direction. Okay, I know that this is the right neighborhood for the being of that. Yeah, it's indifferent because there's not a achievement or non-achievement to it. That doesn't diminish the profundity of the feeling for me.
That makes sense.
I think that
there's
a hang on.
Phone for Marvette, please.
What I hear, the two of you, it's like Ivan's kind of agreeing with you, but he's not using the same words. Like, he's not acknowledging that, yes, it is profound specifically, but he's saying that it's not the initial inspirational stuff. It's beyond that. And you're using the word profound. And so, you know, I don't think that there's really a difference between what you're saying, except that it's not very clear, either one of them.
Not very clear, yeah.
Well, that's a good
that's
point.
That's probably not unusual.
But that's a good point, because it is clear and distinct within me, however. It's like there's a clear and distinct signature to that feeling.
Well, I'm getting, I think we have a real, I don't know how many other people who are with us, you know, in this circle tonight have this resonance, I would imagine that you have some, you have it to some degree. This is, I felt right away that David's talking about a childhood experience, which I can remember,
mm-hmm.
which I feel that I had, because it was, it's to me, when thinking back on it now as an adult, you know, as an old grown-up person, it's the characteristic of it is wordlessness, speechlessness.
But I'm telling you, like, I've got it right now, Ivan.
Well, great.
Not that I started recognizing it about 8 or 9.
Yeah.
But I have it today. Today, there's this sense of the inexpressible, something, a profound feeling that something very great is, but inexpressible is. It's like and I think what I'm learning from listening, working with EJ's material, is that it is that spark of the divine. It's not me in a sense, but I'm not afraid that it's in there too. I'm not afraid. I'm glad that it's in there. It's partly that is which defines my life. There you go.
Amalara says, I think it is a hard thing to describe for anyone. And Auntie Matter says, in the creative act, there is still a separation.
Yes.
In the bliss, there is union.
Yeah, whenever there's an expression of it, and I think all the great artists will say this too, there's a diminishment of it. I don't need to express it in a sense. I don't, it's just, you know, when I say, who am I? That's who am I. It stands around that profound feeling of the inexpressible importance of this work. Not this work, but the existence that I've been given. Each person will find that paragraph in however they find it. It'll be different for everybody. I would imagine. We'll just read the last paragraph here. Do you want to go ahead and read that, Ivan?
Yeah, I think we should. These are some of the signs of the unveiled vision. There are other indications that presence has been successfully invoked. Some of these indications may lead directly to temporary or permanent placement in a home reserved for very special people just like yourself. And so it is strongly suggested that you resist the temptation to wear on the lapel some button which tells any interested and also at the same time an equal number of disinterested party or parties that you have occasionally achieved the unveiled vision.
Well, you know, I've got a lot of people that I hang out with, a lot of friends. There's virtually nobody that I can speak to. There's a self, you know, filtering sensation. Even this, even sharing that, what I just shared, I feel uncomfortable about sharing it even here.
That's interesting. I think I feel uncomfortable about sharing it every place else than
well,
here. So.
But it's so there's a sense of intimacy of stating that is a little fearful for me.
David, I think you struck a word that is actually a key word for these kind of spaces. You said that there's a sense of intimacy. Mm-hmm. And that, in our culture, actually is so misused. And that you're using that word in association with the divine, and it's so different than how people ordinarily look at it, because they look at it really psychologically, and it's just a different animal.
And so therefore it makes it really hard to put into words, because it's something that one experiences it, and they know by their own experience. And that creates a vibration.
There you go.
And you can trigger that vibration, and that will activate kind of a resonating love of others that have that also within them. And sometimes they're occluded at that time for whatever reason, but if they're clear enough, they'll recognize that, and it just you know, it intensifies, and space gets, you know, more and more honed. But it's also goes with a being quiet inside. Like, yeah, there's all these battles that you can have with the ego, but if you just kind of, each is using the phrase recently, get over yourself,
yeah.
You know, and be quiet. He didn't say, and be quiet. I'm adding that to get a little bit more clarification on that phrase. There's like a receptivity of what is in the space, what is in the present, and allowing yourself to be there too, and experiencing what that is. So, yeah, it's hard to put words to it. But intimacy, if you kind of go down that road and throw out a part of